Many years back when these old oaks were young, not long after the Northmen had come, a lone evil deed was done in the dark of the New Forest. In the dark of the New Forest.
You are listening to The Deceptionist, Truth Through Fiction, a fortnightly or so podcast dedicated to the art and craft of storytelling. We strive to bring a sense of community to the solitary life of the writer. My name is Caroline, and I will be leading this week's discussion on historical fiction, which goes in with a series of shows we have been doing on different genres. This week is a little bit unusual because we had a recording mishap, and so the show is a little bit short, not because we did not have anything to say on the topic. We had a lot to say on the topic. Unfortunately, we lost some of the audio that we had recorded. So it's the show, like I said, it's going to be a little short, and we're missing out on the introductions. And so I want to be clear that you're going to be hearing me. I'm Caroline, one of our normal panelists. You're also going to be hearing Kelly and Jim. And our special guest is Sigrid Ellis, who is one of my companions from the Fantastic Fangirls website, definitely a friend of the show. She has come to join our Show Your Work segment on historical fiction. I believe my voice will be the first one you're hearing. Sigrid's voice will be the second. Sigrid is a fiction writer and editor, and she has published in the Strange Horizons online magazine a urban fantasy story called No Return Address, which is not directly historical fiction, but I knew her well, know she's a great student of history, and was really interested in talking about this topic, and she's brought a piece to read for us, which we'll hear later in the podcast, which is a historical fiction piece. So I apologize that we've left out a lot of the conversation. It'll be resumed in progress. I'll try to have a post up on the website that explains some of the things that we might reference that didn't make it onto the audio show. But I still think that what we have is a really good, solid podcast, and hope that you will enjoy it.
About writing characters in a different time, historical settings with original character. M.I. Milliman, who's one of our super fans, I believe, on Twitter, says his question that he had for us is, if the story's set in a different time, does the setting or time become the story, or is it still the characters? What do we think?
I think that you need to be faithful to a historical setting as a character in the same way you would a character you created. They have their quirks and their motivations, and they have their blind spots. Historical time periods have certainties about the way the world works that we do not share today, which inform the actions of all persons living within that time period. And if you are standing outside that time period and judging it, I think you are not presenting the character of the history appropriately. However, I don't think that lets you off the hook and lets you write bad characters. I think you still need to do both. You just need to treat the setting as an additional character who you need to be honest with.
I think that's part of the problem that I have with a lot of the Regency romances that I read, because the main character is too modern.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of, like, that heroine would not exist in this time period. Like, she wouldn't say those things, she wouldn't act that way, and if she did, she would get whipped to an inch of her life.
Well, it does seem like every piece of historical fiction I read is about some long-distant time period and the most independent woman who had ever existed during that time period. Like, they're all breaking boundaries.
Right. On the other hand, you get to go read the biography of Georgiana, the Duchess of Spencer, who was, by our current 21st century standards, extremely modern in her views and attitudes. However, if you were writing historical fiction about her, which people have, there was a movie made about her called The Duchess, you need to present the modernity of her views in the language and the mode of that day. You can't have her say something like, you know, well, this marriage is just complete, you know, completely ridiculous. She wouldn't say that. She would say something along the lines of, marriage is a complex political and social animal with many nuances, and perhaps we should discuss zoology together. You can have modern, what we call modern, they're not modern, but you can have what we call modern attitudes as long as you write them properly.
Right. I didn't even think about it when I was doing it, but right before we began this show, I was reading a piece of work that was set in 1775 and was completely hung up on the language that was coming out of the characters' mouths. Usually, when this happens to me, it's because they're using colloquialisms and slang and things that I don't think had been in existence at the time. But in this case, the author was trying so hard for accuracy that I was getting completely hung up on the these and the thous and the yees, and mm-hmm. you know, it got to the point where I was, you know, thinking in the opposite direction. I'm not sure that the language was this formal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and honestly, reading fiction and reading letters from the time period that you're in is probably as good a way to approach that as any, because I'm actually reading a 19th century novel now, and I keep finding idioms that I'm like, I had no idea people said that. So it's like some things that just sound like modern language to us aren't necessarily, and some things that we think are historical speak are modern inventions.
There was a point I was going to raise earlier when we were discussing the Titanicization of historical fiction, which is that exactly the point you just made, Caroline, which is that if you want to write historical fiction, you cannot read historical fiction. What you need to do is go read the products of that time period, and that will give you what people thought of Picasso, or whether they said "damn you to hell," or whether, you know, it was commonly known that, you know, that the most modern, up-to-date people in New York City, none of them, you know, kept their marriage vows. Did people in South Carolina know that? Let's read the newspaper and find out.
Mm-hmm.
So that is so much work.
Well, then the question also becomes, why are you writing it in that period? I've heard the distinction made with Regency romance specifically, that you have Regency romance and you have Regency dress romance. And some of it is just blatantly written by people with, you know, written where the characters have modern attitudes and they have modern sexual practices, basically. But people like the costumes and people like the sort of social situations that are created by the Regency situation. And if you're writing the book for that reason, and if you're writing it for people who don't give a shit about whatever particular – I was thinking about this because I guess on television, Mad Men has really kind of ruined everything else that wants to be a historical piece because they're so meticulous. And like, I was watching Dirty Dancing last week.
Oh man!
And I was, which I love that movie, but and some of the things, like, okay, that is seems right for the 1960s in that culture, and a lot of it, like Jennifer Grey's hair, for instance. You know,
whatever do you mean?
And I wonder if when they remake it, if they're going to feel like they have to go for making it more actually what the 60s would be like. But a film like that is kind of the equivalent of the Regency dress romance. It's mm-hmm. for somebody, you want the idea of what the 60s symbolize, and you want the music and some of the culture, but you're not expecting for a professor of modern culture to be sitting there checking off a box, which people do when they watch Mad Men, and then they email the people who make it. So it's kind of who are you talking to as well. But then the question is, why are you writing that era if you don't really care about that era?
I think there are some, in the same way that taking a complicated idea and translating it into fantasy and science fiction enables you in many ways to talk about your idea without hurting any currently existent or modern group, or you can talk about your family without hurting your family, or mm-hmm. you can talk about politics without having to get the college basketball career of your state senator correct. In the same way, if you are taking examples from history and it relieves of some of the burden of recreating an entire situation in a fantasy or science fiction setting, while also relieving you somewhat of the burden of getting all of the current day details absolutely correct, you can say, I want to write about class conflict, and you can choose the 1950s and 60s U.S. You can choose the 19-teens in England or the 1960s or 70s in England. You can write about class conflict in the 1820s in China. You have a number of historical periods you can work with, and you're given a setup. You're given, okay, we're in the 19-teens in England, so that means the noble houses are, you know, running out of money, and the people who are their servants are looking for better jobs, and everyone's moving from the country to the cities, but the people in the cities don't have work, and there's a war looming. Okay, go. And everybody kind of knows that. And then you have Downton Abbey.
Oh,
right.
Oh, hey, good one.
And sometimes it's just a practical matter, too. Just like the invention of the cell phone has ruined horror.
Yes.
You know, like you're constantly going, well, why don't you just call, you know, or
there's the obligatory, we have no cell phone signal here scene.
Right, exactly. You have to set up why the most obvious solution is not available to these poor souls. And then there was a Caleb Carr book called The Alienist years ago that was, it was basically the typical hunt for a serial killer sort of police procedural, but it was set in 1896. In New York City. So you got a chance to look at the ways that things have changed and the ways that things are the same in New York. But at the same time, fingerprints are considered, you know, nonsense by the establishment. And Teddy Roosevelt is the police commissioner, and we all sort of know where he ends up. So in a lot of ways, you choose a setting like that because you want to make people, you know, make people think about how far we've come, or rob the investigator of the easy tools that we would have forensically now if we were telling the same story or something like that.
Technological advancement is an excellent reason to set things in history.
And he also, because I read that book ages ago, but I think he was also really explicitly interested in the psychological theories of the time. And so he was able to use that to, in some ways it was the birth of modern psychology as well as all that stuff. So yeah, so there's a lot of reasons that you could see for using that. So I think that that's a good
There are other psychological reasons to write in history as well, not to beat this completely into the ground, but if you want to write a story about people who think that the world is full of unlimited possibility and the expanses are wide open, you can write about the 1960s space race. You can write about the opening of the American West. You can write about the 1400s and 1500s aids of exploration from a Spanish point of view. Or you can write about the Chinese exploration of Africa in the 1420s. You can choose, again, if you have a kind of emotion that you want to convey or adventure you want to convey, you can handpick through history and say, I want to write about this. I can spend a couple of days or weeks reading up on some books and learning more about that and seeing if this works for me, and then you can go from there.
And I think maybe that gives you the opportunity to, if you're a good writer or if it's the kind of thing you're interested in, to really explore people in the ways that the things that aren't different now than were then. And I think, I feel like most of the good historical fiction that I've read, just like the good fiction I've read that was written 200 years ago, what the reason it works is that it connects to the things that you can point out that are universal. And it's very tricky to do that without being hit you over the head, this is a parallel to something that's happening right now, right?
You can't talk to me about modern economics and politics at parties because I start saying things like, well, in 1882, you understand that, and then I'm just terrible.
Right. Well, I remember in the late 90s, the Gilded Age was big, and I assume right now the Depression is big, and, you know, all kinds of – so it's definitely –
I find that when I'm just reading nonfiction history, that I take great comfort in the parallels that are always being drawn. Like the aforementioned David McCullough John Adams book, I found that every chapter or so I was taken aback by John Adams complaining about how rude New Yorkers are, and, you know, how stuck up the French are, and all the things that you sort of think about as stereotypes in 2011 were exactly the same in 1778. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a certain sense of continuity that gets established, and I think maybe that's the point of looking back like this too. We kind of take solace in the fact that even though it always seems like we're on the cusp of the apocalypse, people have always sort of thought that way, and we somehow managed to muddle through.
It does rather make me want to pound my cane on the floor and smack my dentures back and forth and talk about the young whippersnappers these days. But I try very hard to keep that to myself.
Oh, don't hold back.
Sigurd, do you want to talk a little bit about how you, what it was you were looking for in the story that you wrote, and then go ahead and read it for us?
What I was looking for in the story I wrote, which I'm not going to read all of because I am shopping it around and hoping someone will publish it. What I was looking for was a combination of a look at the necessary underpinnings of any industrial society, particularly the kind of industrial fantasy that steampunk is. And at the same time, I had a completely different story about what it is to be a parent and realizing that the events in your life really aren't about you anymore once you have children. And I ended up splicing those two things together in a way that I hope works.
Now, let me ask you before you read this, do you have a specific date and place that this takes place?
No, no, which is one of the story's flaws. honestly, I do not have a specific day and date. I have a time period, the late 1850s, because it's in the Great Milling Expansion that happened just prior to the Civil War. That was one of the reasons that the North won the Civil War, and I really won't go into that too much right now.
So show your work.
Okay, show my work. The ghost told Charlotte that her daughter, Dot, was not among the evacuated children splashing in the mill pond. Sarah materialized in the spring sunlight as an insubstantial head and shoulders, her firmly gesticulating hands pointing back to the smoldering cotton mill. Charlotte looked at Sarah with growing alarm. The spirit showed herself to Charlotte from time to time, but never so boldly. She was no medium, no spirit raiser charged by God to witness visions of the dead. Charlotte ran to find Mr. Johnson as soon as she understood Sarah's frantic motions. Not that the finding of him had done her any good. She spied him berating the carding foreman with shouted words and raised fists. Mr. Johnson was not a sympathetic man at the best of times, and Charlotte had never seen him at that hypothetical best time. Charlotte kept her own counsel, kept out of Mr. Johnson's sight, and ran back into the yet unburned Jenny house to search for Dot. Standing on the mill floor, Charlotte tried to think. While Charlotte worked at the mule Jenny's, spinning fine cotton thread for ladies all over the world, Dot was still small enough to be a spindle runner. When Charlotte as a child had worked at that task, the spindle runners would rest and hide behind the massive rotative beam engine named Ariadne by the mill's absent owner. Charlotte peered through the hot, now hazy air towards where she thought Ariadne sat. A shimmering glow beckoned to her from ahead. "Thank you, Heavenly Father," Charlotte whispered, half running through the gloom. Sarah was still with her. The ghost shimmered by Ariadne pointing. Charlotte crouched down by the giant flywheels. She kept her fingers well clear of the belts. They were still now, but the machinery of the factory was like the rifle her father had kept above the mantle of her childhood home. That gun, he had told her sternly, was always loaded. Even if she had just seen him take out the cartridge, the gun was always loaded. The flywheel may be still, the steam cut off, the factory quiet, but Charlotte knew that a flywheel was always treated as if it were spinning, always. She'd seen too many fingers torn away by the power of the machines. There, Dot huddled behind the piston. Her dress was dirty and her face pale, but she seemed unharmed. Charlotte beckoned to her. "Dorothy, quickly now, come with me before the building lights." Dot shook her head and pulled her skirt to one side. Charlotte's mind refused at first to comprehend what her eyes saw. A shackle, a length of chain, locks. What? Charlotte's voice was barely audible to her own ears. "I lied to Mr. Johnson," Dot said. "Joseph was sick and went to the privy without permission, and I told Mr. Johnson that Joe was running an errand for Mr. Makepeace, and Mr. Johnson caught Joe coming back and thrashed him." Dot's mouth trembled as she spoke. "And Mr. Johnson said I could stay here and oil the flywheels and consider God's grace in my sins." Charlotte now saw the oil pot and the oxtail brush sitting on the floor. The belts on the flywheels dried out in the crisp fall air. They needed constant attention, lest they crack and break apart with deadly force. The snap belt could kill a person 15 feet away, yet the job was dangerous in itself. The spaces in and under Ariadne were too small for a man, too small for most women. The children of the factory fit perfectly. They dodged the spinning gears and whirring belts, avoided the scalding steam pipes, and applied whale oil to the buffalo hide leather of the great machine. "But he chained you?" Charlotte asked. Dot nodded. "He said he couldn't trust me." Her mouth worked, and when she spoke again, her voice was much smaller, betraying her 7 years. "Mama, is the fire very near?" "No, not near at all," Charlotte replied. She looked around. "Sweetheart, do you know where Mr. Johnson left the key?" "He put it in his pocket," Dot said softly. Charlotte's hands and feet became cold so suddenly it was as if she'd fallen into the mill pond. Her voice, when she spoke, sounded perfectly cheerful, utterly calm, yet it was distant as if from behind thick walls. "What a silly thing for him to do," she heard herself say, "and how just like a man to be so inconvenient." Charlotte backed away from Ariadne and stood. "We'll simply have to break it now, won't we?" Dot almost smiled at the description of Mr. Johnson, a brute who applied his hand liberally to women and children alike, as silly, and she nodded firmly when Charlotte said they must break the chain. That's the end of it.
Ooh. And just... Wow. So somebody needs to publish that story so we can find out how it ends?
Yes. Seriously. Like, that was just not cool.
Somebody needs
especially
to publish
because her name is Charlotte.
Oh, that's your daughter, isn't it?
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am. It's all right.
That piece, if I'm going to be honest with you, I wouldn't be surprised if an editor handed that piece back to me and said, it sounds a little bit like a history text. Because I'm looking at it now and thinking... I was trying to jam in an awful lot of fact about factory life into those 800 words. But that's the thing with historical fiction. I'm still working on that balance. I don't know how much historical detail is expected from a historical fiction reader. And when I am a historical fiction reader, I will accept pages and pages of people talking about flatware service and the smelting of bronze and how indigo was harvested in the middle of a piece of a story of a murder mystery. I will take that. But that doesn't mean that it is the best approach. On the other hand, if you don't include that detail, then you have a ghost story about a mother and a daughter in why is the daughter trapped? Why can't they go to the authorities? All those details need to somehow be explained by the setting, or else it's just weird and stupid. You know, why didn't they call 911?
Yeah. Did the detail about chaining the child to the machine, is that from something you read that was historical, or was that you kind of extrapolating?
I extrapolated that from the fact that workers were routinely locked in.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major causes of fire-related deaths in early industrial America was that workers were just routinely locked in so that they wouldn't skive off and go take their lunch break somewhere else, or they wouldn't steal. So when a fire broke out, everybody died.
Yeah, so the details, that was obviously the detail that jumped out. But you're right, that if you didn't have the rest of it there to kind of give you an idea about it, it would have just... It's something like that. It's easy for it to seem too extreme.
Yeah.
And I don't think it does, because I think you can see how it fits. But go ahead.
It's a balance. I think it is extremely plausible that factory foreman, I will say foreman because they were all men, would lock workers to machines, particularly if they were worried about union activism. It seems very plausible. I cannot off the top of my head think of an instance which I know that happened, but I know that it was not – if this is the late 1850s, then shackling your workers doesn't seem all that outre.
There are parts of the world where I wouldn't be surprised to learn it was going on now.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's the thing. Like, it may not be something you can cite in a history book, but, I mean, frankly, you don't have a story if she's not attached to the machine.
Right.
If her like, then her mom just goes in and says, okay, great, let's go, and then she leaves, and then the story's over.
The necessity of the storytelling said that there need to be a reason for her to go, for her daughter not to be able to come out. What would a plausible reason be?
And I feel once you sort of establish this world where you have 7-year-old girls working around industrial machines because they're the only people small enough to get inside them, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it's not hard to make that jump.
Yeah. That was my thinking.
And it's actually terrifying. Like, I mean, I know you talked about this one of the things you wanted to explore was sort of the nature of parenthood in these situations. Like, of course, from a professional standpoint, you need the tiny little people to crawl into the big giant machines to get there because it's actually safest if it's the tiny little people.
That was a real children's job in these
places. Yeah, I mean, I could see that being a rational, trait of thought. But as a parent, like, that's terrifying, and that, you know, going back to what we said earlier, that's why one writes historical fiction, is to explore those sort of situations that we don't have quite as often today.
Well, there's another piece of history coming into this too, which is that for a number of reasons, many of the books that my partner and I read to are, when I wrote this 7-year-old but now 8-year-old children, a number of the books we read were books written in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And in those books, the ages of the children who go off and have adventures are from age 5 to 13, typically speaking. And in those books, the Boxcar Children, for example, in those stories, 5- and 6- and 7-year-olds are portrayed as being fully capable of certain levels of competence and decision-making and agency. And I remember reading books like that when I was younger and agreeing with that sentiment, thinking, yes, this 9-year-old can make a life-changing decision about whether or not she's going to devote her life to ballet. Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me. And I am looking at my 8-year-old daughter and son, and I am thinking, what the fuck?
Right.
And part of the story that I wrote and the other story I had published is the bizarreness of that mental shift of going, I remember thinking that was a legitimate decision for a 7 or 8 or 9-year-old to be making in that book as to whether or not, you know, they were going to forage for firewood because they were living on their own in the woods and were homeless. And now I'm a parent of children the age of those protagonists, and it gives me the cold shivers.
Sure.
I can remember being 12 and babysitting like an 18-month-old and a 4-year-old, like into the night, like while the parents went out to dinner.
Yes.
And I have a 4-year-old and a 15-month-old, and it's like there is no way I would leave them by themselves with another child. Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going to explore those themes, do I write about, you know, me now, or do I write about me at age 15, or do I write about me at age 9? Or is it easier for me to look at those themes with the tongs of history? For me personally, it's easier to look at it with fiction and fantasy and history than to try to write some kind of autobiographical essay, memoir-y type thing, which I enjoy reading when they're well written, but that's not my skill set.
And can I take this to a really depressing place?
Go for it.
It's interesting, all the stuff we're talking about with children and just the way that society has shifted, I think it's important to realize and to be reminded that that didn't just happen. It didn't just like, well, it used to be that 8-year-olds work in factories and now, in America, they don't. You know, in places that we know about in America, they don't. But that, you know, this sort of, there's these conscious choices that took us from that place to where we are now. And to kind of, and you know, where you see those protections be removed when you're talking about dystopia or science fiction about the future. So,
right.
You know, I think those, in a sense, the history and the sort of dystopia or the fantasy are connected in the sense of, I think, helping to bring home what it is that we value now and the fact that it's not immutable. See, I took that to a depressing place.
Well, I mean, my whole interest in reading about the Victorian era in history came about from a convention, a science fiction convention years ago, where a friend of mine, hi Heidi, sat down and started listing off the amount of industrial technology and manual labor that would go into making a whalebone corset. Steampunk costumes were just on the rise at this convention. There were a number of women walking around in corsets, and she started ticking off on her fingers. And I started matching her with the number of people per out of every 10 who were likely killed in industrial accidents in all of those industries that she was listing that were going into the dyeing of the fabric and the killing of the whales and the sailing and getting the whalebone and the spinning of the thread and the where is the cotton raised? It was probably from India and how did it get shipped to the mills and all of this stuff. So, you know, I can match your depressing place with industrial accidents. I completely agree that that is part of why we poke at these things, is to say, if that's how we as a people used to be and we're not that way anymore, why not? What was good about that? What was bad about that? Can we talk about this in a joyous way, or can we talk about it in a more serious and critical way? And that was the end of my thought.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about why we write historical fiction and why we like to read it and why we like to write it. But since this is a show about the craft of storytelling, can you talk a little bit about the research that you did or didn't have to do because your inherent knowledge of cotton mills exceeds Eli Whitney's? Like, how do you go about that? And how do you know when you've done enough research? And how do you transition from that sort of research mode to the storytelling mode?
You start out by doing not enough research, and then you do too much research, and then you start writing, and then you realize that you are actually writing a dry treatise that college freshmen would throw spitballs at, and then you cut out a whole bunch of all the painfully collected research that you've done, and you replace it with character development, and then you find that the plot you have doesn't really work with the things you've cut out missing, so you rework that, and then eventually you use the same tools you use on anything else, which is you beat at it until your characters and your plot come into alignment, and you trim everything that doesn't advance the plot or the character. That every historical thing I've done, and all the people who write historical fiction who I've heard talk about it, all say that. You start out with not enough knowledge. You read a whole bunch of stuff, you come up with all this information, and then you cut 2/3 of it.
So that is a process.
Did I lose every?
No, I think we're all here.
You're all here, and you're just stunned by the ridiculousness of that.
No, you've just distilled our entire existence as a podcast into a 30-second soundbite of, this is how you write, folks. Move on.
So that'll do it.
Yes.
This is the end of The Deceptionists. From now on, just listen to that clip.
Join us next week where we begin to discuss pies.
Nothing wrong with pie. Yeah, but I think that form and length do enter it, because I feel like it's interesting to think about writing something. I admire trying to write something small as historical fiction. And if you think about it, you know, sometimes I read nonfiction articles about a really interesting historical event, and that's all I really need to read about it, because the writer's done such a good job of putting everything in there. And I would think that there's room for that with fiction, but I just wonder if it's like, if the books tend to get long because people have all this information that they want to share, or is there a way besides what you just said to keep something that short and accessible?
I'm pondering, and I think that in the various genres I read that also use historical angles, the science fiction and fantasy books tend to get quite long, but the mysteries often keep it short. And I'm trying now, without having read any of the Anne Perry or Laurie King books in the last 5 years, to think how they do it. It might just be that if your primary genre is mystery and the conventions of mystery are you, by God, stay on plot, that it forces you to write shorter. But I'm just thinking out loud. That's not a firm theory. Mystery does seem to me to be one of the less forgiving genres when it comes to form.
Yeah, we were talking about that on the last show. Do we want to talk about any specific historical periods? I know the Western was originally what we were going to talk about, which has its own conventions as a form. And I wonder if that's one where you do have a lot of short writing in Western when it was popular, because it's something that people are already kind of familiar with the basic setup, or people who read that, you know, and you kind of recognize it from a movie. And I was also thinking about the fact, one thing that's interesting about the Western is that it didn't start as, quote, historical fiction. It started as people writing, you know, supposedly memories of things that had happened in their lifetime or that they'd witnessed.
Amazingly lurid memories.
Yes. Yeah, probably with quite a bit of exaggeration. But it wasn't so much about time as much as it was about place. It was about people in the East or in Europe or whatever who wanted to know about the West. So then that's something that kind of got solidified. So, but it also seems like the Western has kind of a particular form that we're still able to go back to and that gets called on in other genres as well. I don't know if anybody had anything else specific about the Western.
I think it's a good example of a time period that has enough, I think tropes probably isn't the exact right word, but there's enough of a framework that you can say this is a Western, and there's already, you know, you've got the tools in the box, everyone's already drawn what the small town looks like, and there's already tumbleweeds without you having to describe what a tumbleweed is. And I think it's one of those genres that you can shortcut a lot, and so then you can write shorter pieces in it.
And I feel like even if you want to write a revisionist Western, you're able to do that because you're able to say, well, everybody thinks gunfights were like this, but actually so-and-so. Whereas if you're coming into one of the – if you're coming into a genre that people don't necessarily – or a time period people don't necessarily have a lot of knowledge of, there's a Japanese comic book called Uku, which – have you read that, Sigrid?
Not yet.
And it's an interesting comic book, but it's basically a alternate history of Japan if a lot of the men basically had died out, and so women took up certain places in society. And it's a well-done series. I've kind of had trouble following it as I went along because it's written by a Japanese writer for a Japanese audience who I think assumes that the people reading this know the basic outlines of this history, which I'm like, okay, that's clearly a real person that I would have heard of if I'd read about this era, and I haven't. So I think there is a sort of audience thing going on there.
It's a lot like me and the DC reboot. I read these number ones, and I've never read any DC comics before this, and I'm like, am I supposed to know this? Is this a new person? Is this a rebooted person?
All I can say is I am not the person to ask as to which periods of history are ones everybody knows about and which aren't, because I'm sitting here while you're talking about how, well, everyone has enough tools for the Western. I'm racking my brains going like, well, what period of history wouldn't people know about? And I'm coming up with 6,000 years of history that I know something about and going, oh, I'm not the right person to talk about this.
Yeah. Here's the thing, 90%, and I'm a bad student of history, but 90% of the things that you were saying, like, well, if you start here, you know XYZ, and if you want to talk about race relations, you can do X. And I'm just like, yeah, no. I have this note in my head that's like, anytime you do anything historical, call Sigrid and find out where you can.
I think you should wrap up. I don't have anything else to say.
Okay, so a lot of great thoughts about history and historical fiction. Now we're going to take a little bit of time to talk about what we're working on now as writers. Sigrid, do you want to go first?
I am mostly working on editing because I am the editor of the forthcoming book Chicks Dig Comics, and we are in the final draft crunch, and that is all I have time for.
Understandable.
Which it's available for pre-order on Amazon.
It's available for pre-order on Amazon at this time.
I knew we were going to plug that eventually, so I'm glad that you were ever to do
that. And Weedonistas, another book in the Mad Norwegian Girl Geek series, which I have an essay in, is now an e-book available on Kindle and Nook.
Awesome. Yes. Kelly, what about you?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I took the summer off. I don't know how much of our sabbatical we covered on the last podcast because I haven't listened to it yet.
Not that much.
But I took the summer off from pretty much everything and have discovered that with life being as zany as it is, I pretty much can either read or can write. I don't have the capacity to sort of spin both things in my head. Mm-hmm. So I read all summer. I read the entire Hunger Games trilogy, which granted didn't take that long, but that's pretty much what I did this summer. But I have started, I picked my my romance fantasy series back up. And I've written a couple of chapters on that. And I dig it a lot. And in fact, I think I may write a different one of those for NaNoWriMo this year, but I haven't decided yet, which we will get to in a later podcast.
Yeah, I think we're trying to decide how much we want to talk about that because we're trying to decide how many of us are doing it. That's good.
You should definitely, definitely cover NaNoWriMo. Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, but that was kind of where our starting point was last year because I think we started basically right afterwards. Uh-huh. I think it'd be interesting to come back around to that. What about you, Jim?
Well, I'm trying to decide if I'm going to do that thing you were just talking about, for one thing. In addition to that, I'm looking at expanding a little bit on the story that I wrote for last week, or it was basically the beginning of the story. So now I have to decide if I'm going to end it or not, or if it's best just left hanging like that. And then I've also foolishly volunteered to write a series of reviews for iFanboy.com on the brand new DC Comics that are coming out. And I really didn't think that through when I was volunteering to do it, because they don't give me free copies of those books.
Oh, my.
And I just was like, oh, yeah, I'll just buy all that stuff and read it. No, so yeah, I'm trying to... I'm not entirely comfortable giving reviews, and maybe this is something we can talk about on a future podcast, because I'm not comfortable with the voice of God authoritative declarations of what makes the work good or bad, and I'm not always sure I have the necessary tools or equipment intellectually to articulate my, you know, book good.
I think
you have to read all of Deadpool before you decide that Deadpool is so good.
That's right.
But then, yeah. But I think that is, though, interesting for fiction writing at some point to talk about the critical.
I have a lot to say about that.
About Deadpool?
No, about reviewing.
About reviewing. All right. And I am, God, what if I have been very real life busy for the last while, and I'm getting out of that a little bit. So I'm picking up a longer piece that keeps getting longer in my head. So at this point I have, you know, everything about the character's backstory worked out, and you know how much of this is actually relevant to the story I should be writing.
We'll keep sending it to me.
Okay.
Sending it to me.
And so, and then I'll kind of see where I am with that to decide what my NaNoWriMo strategy is going to be. I came back from Dragon Con a few weeks ago really psyched because I had gone to the literature track there, which you would not, it's actually Dragon Con is not all people dressing up as Klingons and or Dothraki, which you would think it was, but there is a lot of people talking about books and writing, and I met some really interesting people. So that got me really psyched about short fiction again, but I'll see what I'm feeling, because I have been thinking I was going to try to do something long in November, and I may try to come back to that. So that's my very vague what I am, you know, thinking about working on. So, all right. Well, do we want to just do a quick outro and talk about where you can find us on the internet? Our website, which is up now as far as I know, is thedeceptionist.org. We're on Twitter at deceptionist, no the. And you can email us at contact@deceptionist.org. Sigrid, where can people find you on the internet?
By my name, which is, as far as I know, unique on the internet. Sigrid Ellis on Twitter. And if you Google that, you find my blog on WordPress, Thinking Too Much. And I'm on Fantastic Fangirls.
Right. Also on fantasticfangirls.org. I am on Twitter as @MadMarvelGirl.
I'm Anna Luna on Twitter, A-N-N-A-L-U-N-A. That's about it.
I am Jimski on Twitter, JimSki, and that's all you need to know.
All right, now let's all say goodbye and thank you for listening.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening.
On the shores of Normandy, King William came to Albion fair, King Harold to slay. With greed in his heart and a scurrilous claim, he took the land for his own. He took the land for his own.
On the other hand, in some ways, I'm more forgiving in movies because you get the extra thing you get is that you're watching it be dramatized. You're watching somebody be this person, which perhaps with right. Johnny Cash, you don't really need. That's an interesting question. Why do you need to see somebody be Johnny Cash who is there's plenty right. of, or Elvis?
Or yes. But, if only we had some film to remember these people by.
About the fact, maybe we'll cut this out, maybe we won't, that there is a scene in Birds of Prey that came out today explaining why Barbara Gordon is not on the Birds of Prey. And I'm like, you know, that's not really starting from square one, because if I'm actually somebody who's never read this comic before, I don't need to know 2 pages of why this person is not in this book. I don't know.
Because you don't need to know, right, why a character you've never heard of isn't on a team you're hearing about for the first time.
Right, exactly.
I actually kind of felt that way when I was reading she's Batgirl, right? No?
Yeah. Yeah, we're not this is totally gonna go at the end.